From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, what might we see as Governor Snyder gets ready to unveil his newest budget?
I'll be looking to see, you know, especially what he does with education. He took a lot of grief for cutting education, you know, in the 2011 budget.
Plus, even as the Detroit 3 automakers turn in strong January sales, what challenges lie ahead?
I think my point is there's a lot of storm clouds out there, and we don't exactly know how this is going to play out over the longer term.
And a conversation with new music teacher, composer, and performer Bill Ryan. His Bill Band, out with its first new CD in nearly a decade.
What I tell my students who I teach composition at Grand Valley, and they kind of walk in and don't know what they're getting into, and I always tell them it is not a lightning bolt striking me and the piece comes out.
Those stories and more today, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. Happy Wednesday, everybody. I'm Cynthia Canty. Post-minimalist music's getting a lot of attention on the music scene. On our show today, we talk with acclaimed contemporary music teacher, composer, producer, and performer Bill Ryan. We talk about his group Bill Band and the making of their first CD in nearly a decade. Plus, high gas prices apparently mean more of us are choosing to hop on a train. We'll talk about rising numbers of rail passengers. But first, news out of Lansing. Governor Snyder announced today that he does support expanding Medicaid eligibility to hundreds of thousands of Michigan residents who don't have insurance. That expansion comes under the Obama administration's health care overhaul. And there are benefits for states that decide to expand Medicaid. The federal government will pick up the entire cost for the first 3 years and 90% over the long haul. But the governor is likely to run into resistance from fellow Republicans who are opposed to the Affordable Health Care Act. Meanwhile, the governor is also gearing up to deliver his budget proposal for fiscal year 2013-2014. That happens tomorrow. Now, you could say unveiling the proposal begins the debate in Lansing over what should and should not be funded. So which programs and which initiatives could be winners and which could be the losers in the governor's spending plan and in what the legislature ultimately does with it? We're joined now by Chris Gouts, who's capital correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business, and Dave Eggert. He's the Lansing reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
Chris, I want to start with you. This budget is really a measure of values, meaning what does Rick Snyder believe to be important enough to spend money on? Now, earlier today, we learned that he will accept those federal funds and he will go ahead to expand Medicaid in Michigan. So what else do you think will be on the governor's list?
Well, I think there could be a number of, you know, big priority items for him because, you know, budgets are about priorities. I mean, that's what a budget is. And so I think in past budgets, we've seen him, take a look at some of the things that he really wants to move forward on. And one of those is just, to be plain, to have a structurally balanced budget, which the state hasn't seen in a number of years. So for him, even though that's not really a sexy thing, I mean, that's probably the most important thing to him, especially as the rating agencies look at Michigan. You know, that's just a big thing in itself. But I think I'll be interested to see whether or not he includes any funds for his transportation plan, whether he assumes that will be, you know, part of that. I'll be looking to see, you know, especially what he does with education. He took a lot of grief, you know, for cutting education in the 2011 budget and then putting some money back. So, you know, it's hard to tell right now the way that the school aid budget is looking, whether or not it's going to be ripe for cuts again. You know, if tradition holds, what we've seen with this Republican legislature do is you cut in the first year and then you add back to the budget during the election year when people are starting to notice. So I'll be looking to see if that sort of holds true again this time around.
Dave Eggert, what's the view from the Associated Press chair?
Oh, I agree with Chris as well. It'll be key to see on his transportation plan. I kind of assume he will assume that he'll be base his plan on some sort of road funding being passed. Last year, the state had to sort of rob from its general fund to make sure it got enough federal money for roads, and I think the governor doesn't want to see that happen again. Another interesting issue of the governor, like Chris said, likes to have a balanced budget, a structurally balanced budget, and he's expected to probably want to set aside some money again for what's known as the rainy day fund, and that could set up some tension in the Capitol as to whether that's the best place for the money to go or not, given priorities in other spending areas.
Well, I want to get the thoughts from both of you on how you think these possible spending goals are going to be received by the legislature, because, of course, we've got Democrats still stinging from everything that happened in lame duck, and especially right to work. And you've got Republicans who might not be very happy about deepening Michigan's involvement in the Obama health care plan. So, Chris, your thoughts on what the legislature will think about these possible goals?
Well, I think one of the things where you'll see some bipartisan, I don't want to say agreement, as they've said, is with the rainy day fund, because that's an issue where you've got some Democrats and Republicans who both don't like the direction that the governor is taking the state in terms of having, you know, a savings account, basically. You know, Democrats are saying, you know, you're cutting all these areas. Why are you still, you know, you've got this big pot of money sitting there, you know, let's lessen some of these cuts. And you've got Republicans saying, how are you going to expect me to vote for a tax increase on the roads when you've got this big pot of money sitting there? So I expect them to probably put some more in there, because, I mean, that's the way he is. I mean, he's a nerd. He's an accountant. He knows mm-hmm. the importance of having that savings in there. So that's one of the things that I think will be received, you know, on a bipartisan way, but in viewing it in a different way. They're also going to be, like I said, the Republicans are going to be, you know, not probably so keen on some of the transportation funding issues, as well as the Medicaid expansion. So those are probably the two one things that I'll be looking for the most.
And the governor's actually admitted he needs bipartisan support for the road issue, that road funding. He's looking for probably more than $1 billion a year. And Dave, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think on the road funding, you're right. I mean, he will need Democratic votes, and I think a key thing to look for, you know, it probably won't be a part of the budget, but going forward in budget negotiations, is just what do Democrats get in return for supporting any sort of additional road funding? You know, they remain upset over tax changes that were made in the governor's first year in office. So I think, you know, I think Democrats are still in the midst of trying to figure out what are they going to ask for. You know, might want to look at tax policy for Michigan residents.
Honestly, if I could add, you know, the governor likes to talk about, especially with transportation, he likes to talk about how this hasn't been done since 97. And, you know, that's when Engler raised revenue for the roads and sort of about the same amount that in some of the ways that the governor's center is looking at. He did so by selling it as sort of a net tax cut for middle-class families, because he paired the increase in the gas tax with tuition credits for college and for child care. So those are two things that Governor Snyder and the Republicans completely eliminated in their 2011 budget. So now it's a tax increase for those same middle class families these last 2 years. So like Dave said, you know, what are Democrats going to get out of this? Are they going to say, let's put some of those back in, or let's increase the EITC or some of these things, so that, you know, they have something to go back and have a reason to vote for the transportation piece?
Are either of you getting a sense that as to how much cooperation, for lack of a better word, Rick Snyder is going to get from Democrats, and he needs it, who are touching back on what we were just talking about with right to work and what happened in lame duck, who are just still, you know, furious over what happened and are going to look to try to stick it to him?
I think the feeling just started to wane a little bit. I don't think it's as fervent as it was, you know, a month ago. There's always going to be that tension just between Democrats and Republicans, but I don't sense that they're just going to continue to just completely vote no, because they have a really sort of a balancing act that they've got to do here. Because while on some of these things the Republicans need Democrats to vote for them, if they push too hard and if they ask for too much, you know, the Republicans can just, if they bring their folks together in a room and say, look, let's just do this ourselves, and then the Democrats are left with nothing. So they can't be too obstinate. They're going to have to try to get some things, but not push too hard, because the Republicans, while they have the majority, they are going to need Democrats' votes for some things. But if they push too much, the Democrats will just find a way to push all of them, push it all through themselves and just get it done.
Dave Eggert, any last predictions looking ahead to Thursday's unveiling?
I think it'll be, it's always interesting to see if there'll be any other kind of proposed tax changes, or another area is fees. See what the governor has planned for hunting and fishing license fees, some other areas. He wants to put more money into dredging Great Lakes, which is a big issue with falling water levels. So there's some other parts of the budget that won't get as much attention that still should be interesting to see how it plays out in coming months.
And final thoughts from you, Chris.
Yeah, I think the dredging issue is something that that is going to be brought up. I believe that's going to be part of a supplemental, but I think he also wants to do that in sort of ongoing funding for the budget. And that is a big interest in the business community as well, because suppliers that move freight on the waterways, you know, they can't ship as much because of the water level. So they want to see something done there, but that's not as, not as much of a state issue. But and then you also always look to see if there's any going to be any prison closures. That's always something in communities that you always want to look for. And then also in the last couple budgets, I know that local municipal governments are going to be looking to see what, if any, new strings that the state's going to attach to their revenue sharing dollars, and also the education community. We've seen strings attached there as well, so that's something that we'll be looking for.
Chris Galtz, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, and Dave Eggert, the Lansing reporter for the Associated Press, giving us some things to watch for as Governor Snyder delivers his budget for fiscal 2013-2014 tomorrow. Guys, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And moving now from Lansing to Detroit. 5 months after the start of jury selection, they've rested the case. Testimony has ended in the corruption trial of former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, his father Bernard, and his close friend, contractor Bobby Ferguson. The three are charged with scheming to enrich themselves by fixing contracts and pressuring businesses to pay bribes, essentially accused of using the mayor's office as a personal piggy bank. The trio all remained silent. They chose not to testify in their own defense, and the Kilpatrick defense offered no new witnesses today. Closing arguments are set for Monday in Detroit federal court. If convicted, they face 20 years in prison. Coming up, with high prices at the gas pumps, some of us are choosing to hop on a train. Ridership on the rails is up. We'll talk more about that. And this year, auto sales are off to a good start. But is there any reason to be concerned? That story coming up in 15 minutes. I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. More and more of us, not just here in Michigan, but across the nation, are traveling by train and turning to Amtrak. Its trains carried 31.2 million passengers in its fiscal year that ended last September. Here in Michigan, a record-setting 793,000 of us traveled on Amtrak's three routes, bringing in all-time high revenues of $27.8 million here in Michigan. Just what's behind our growing affection for the train? Odit Tomer is a researcher with the Brookings Institution. That's a Washington-based think tank, and he joins us now from Washington. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you again. So what do you think, Adi, is behind Amtrak's strong performance, not just nationwide, but really, really here in Michigan?
Yeah, absolutely. We see really similar patterns in Michigan that we're seeing all across the country, which seems to be this quote-unquote renaissance of returning to passenger rail. You know, after so many decades of increasing car ownership, car driving levels, we've seen driving levels starting to table. Domestic aviation even has really started to flatline a little bit, especially since the Great Recession hit a few years ago. But counter to that, passenger rail, after some maybe tumultuous times, you could say,
yes,
through the 70s and 80s, has really started a massive rebound. And it's, again, seen, just as you noted in your introduction, both in Michigan, other states in the Midwest, and especially along the coast, both California, the Pacific Northwest, and then, of course, in the kind of classic Amtrak corridor between Boston and D.C. And behind those patterns is really, to us, a really changing tastes for travel. You know, almost everyone loves riding the train. It's just a question of time. And Amtrak and its statewide partners like Michigan have really done a good job, especially since the Stimulus Act and all the money that's been kind of shoveled across the country to really upgrade services. And what was seen as just maybe a pleasurable form of travel is really now becoming a competitive form of travel. And we're seeing that in both the ridership statistics as well as the revenues that are coming into the company.
So, Adi, are we looking at gas prices, too much construction on the roads, flying is the friendly skies or anything, but is it because people are choosing not to use other forms of transportation versus wanting to take the train?
Yeah, we think it's a little bit of all of the above. You know, just some statistics got released this week that households are spending now on average about $3,000 a year on just gasoline. And that doesn't even include, of course, other associated vehicle costs like insurance, of course, the purchase price. And then roads also actually released just this week is updated congestion stats. And metros all over the country are facing pretty serious vehicle congestion. The airlines, as you mentioned, maybe the unfriendly skies, if you will, especially if you're not flying too far, really seems like a headache all of a sudden to go to the airport, wait through those security lines, no matter what your feelings are on a personal level for security. It simply takes a while now. It's certainly not like what it was pre-9/11. The trains, though, are really, if anything, have actually seen an improvement. More investment, especially from Amtrak and what they call their rolling stock, or the trains that actually you get a chance to ride in. And also trains can, in some ways, leverage that experience from those other modes. So as the highways are congested, it's kind of nice, especially here in the Northeast where I am. You kind of see those cars piled up as your train's zooming by, and it's kind of a good feeling.
Feeling a little smug?
Yeah, exactly. And same thing for aviation, too, right? You know that you go to the train stations, it's smooth and easy to get in and on in the train. And, of course, especially for Michigan's main corridor connecting Detroit, metropolitan Detroit, so stations all across the metro area to metropolitan Chicago, there's certainly advantage of, instead of having to be all the way out at O'Hare or even at Midway, it drops you off right down in downtown Chicago. And what could be easier to do your business or even go to museums or what families might be doing too. So it's really an all-of-the-above situation that really seems to be tilting the deck towards intermetropolitan train service.
We're speaking about the increasing effect toward rail travel with Adito Mayer, who's a researcher with the Brookings Institution. I do want to kind of drill down a little more on this Detroit to Chicago route. I'm quite familiar with it, having loved ones in Chicago and people I know back and forth going to Chicago. And I will say, I don't think anyone that I know personally has taken it, the train, and this was, I'm going to say, over the last 5 years, that hasn't come away saying never again. So it's interesting because it took so long. Or when my daughter took the train to Niles over the summer, the computer on the train broke down and it was it stopped in the middle of a field in the middle of the night. So it was a less than marvelous experience. But it seems that when I look at these growing ridership rates, obviously maybe we were unlucky. I don't know. Or have they made improvements in speed and in accuracy that have helped along?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I think the occurrence that's more common for Americans is kind of that element of getting stuck on the runway in a plane, right? Or just endlessly sitting at the gate, going up to the counter, and the agents, as much as they're trying to be helpful, cannot tell you when you'll take off. And Amtrak, as you just mentioned with your daughter, they have those kind of experiences all across the country, trains getting stuck in the middle of the night, especially those long-distance routes where they have to run on freight rails and you might get stuck in the middle of Montana on a multi-day journey from Seattle to Chicago. And that's really tough, and you feel really helpless, right? That's kind of one of the advantages of the cars. If you're stuck in a traffic jam, at least you feel like you're in control. You can kind of move things. And it's something that both airlines and Amtrak has to battle with. You know, in general, we've seen that Amtrak's on-time performance has been improving dramatically. And it's especially good on those short-haul corridors, of which Michigan, and that's the primary kind of modes that it benefits from.
Right.
The biggest thing that I would kind of say in response, though, is that Amtrak they've heard your complaints, and they've tried to implement new solutions. So what we've seen is that since the Stimulus Act, plus some extra money that came through a couple more appropriations until Congress stopped, they've dedicated an enormous sum, about $400 million, just to the Detroit-Chicago corridor. They bought new tracks, so now everything from Kalamazoo to Dearborn is under Amtrak's control, and the bit that already stretched from Kalamazoo to Chicago was essentially under Amtrak's control to start. And that will allow them to not only install more upgrades, but that exclusive kind of right-of-way for them, or at least the ability to control the tracks more so than the freight rail firm, so kind of flip the table a little bit, will really help these trains run much faster. And our experience, not just here in the United States, but this is a great place to look abroad and beyond our shores, is that if you can get trains running quickly, not just necessarily those really, really high speeds like in Japan or France, but even 110 miles an hour. I mean, I don't know about you, some drivers can go that fast, but there's no way I can maintain those speeds on the interstate. And if we can hit things like 110, which they're planning on between Chicago and Detroit, lower those travel times to something that's certainly faster than driving, even with all the station stops, that's going to generate more and more ridership. That's what we've seen in the Northeast Corridor. They hit some high speeds over in California and have much more frequent departures, which also makes it more competitive and attractive. They've seen big ridership boosts. We would expect that you would see the same between Detroit and Chicago, especially with such a short distance and, frankly, metropolitan areas that share so much in common historically, too. So there's really strong kind of business and family relationships, as you already alluded
yes.
to. Adding that kind of boosted train service can really help bring more people to the service.
And then that just becomes, you know, the more ridership, then the more they can make improvement. So it just becomes self-generating.
Yeah, that's right. Virtuous cycle for sure.
What about other routes? Would that help? And is there a sense that that's on the table in Michigan where there would be just more access because of more routes? We've got the three big ones now, but what do you think Amtrak could do there?
Well, one of the fun things about transportation, right, is kind of plotting new infrastructure investments or new routes in this case, right, all over the map. Everyone likes to think about it, right, or a new highway somewhere. You know, our understanding so far, you know, from our conversations, we have a really big Amtrak paper that's coming out in a couple of weeks, so that'll have a lot of these detailed statistics I'm talking about today. But from talking to them, there's really not any new plans on the books. As some news that was going around last week, just in the state of Michigan, is that I believe it's the House Speaker was not feeling great about the new money that Michigan's going to have to kick into those routes, about $20 million. So functions like that seem to be probably putting the brakes on new routes coming in and out of the state. But because so much good work is going on between Chicago, Detroit, really there's actually the plans are already to improve service from what you see today. So really things are going to get better. Moving forward, it's kind of as you just, you know, we were just speaking about, there's a really nice virtuous cycle to all this. So if more people start taking the Wolverine or the Blue Water, all of a sudden they might start looking, especially at the state level, well, what would it mean to connect more frequently to, let's say, Toledo and Cleveland on the other side of the
right.
lake? Would that attract more ridership? And the better that Amtrak does on the books, the more that Michigan sees that its investments in these routes is paying off in terms of either expanded economic activity or even just really good word from citizens, you know, up to their elected officials, the more likely they will be to invest in those routes. But we definitely want to, you know, speak clearly. No new routes are probably proposed for the near future, but you will see dramatic improvements in the Wolverine once Amtrak and its state partners in Michigan are done with their work.
Adi, what is Amtrak doing with respect to just the amenities within the train cars? Have there been improvements? If somebody has not ridden the train in 5 or 6 years because they had one of those, I don't think so, again, experiences, would they see improvements?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, you know, there's always the element that I think sometimes maybe forget, and I say this as a taller person, is that the legroom is always better on Amtrak. I almost feel like I'm a commercial here for Amtrak, but there's just nothing like a train seat. I mean, it's in many ways not necessarily the smoothest ride, but you're certainly not going to have the potential of turbulence. And the legroom is just fantastic. They tend to have power outlets now. I'm not sure if the trains that the rolling stock that's in Michigan tends to have that. But the biggest thing we've seen, and I don't know if this is on the plans for the Wolverine, but one would expect, especially if they're investing in new trains, is Wi-Fi access, which is really nice, especially for those who might be traveling for business between Detroit and Chicago. Really allows them to stretch out their business day, you know, which is certainly not something you're capable of when driving. So in general, the trains, by making the investment in the tracks, will certainly run smoother. And when, with the potential for Wi-Fi and other amenities, it's definitely something that can be a more pleasurable activity, certainly versus driving. And these days, frankly, different and better than aviation, too.
Well, we've often said, just to get from the Metro Detroit area to Chicago, why would you fly? By the time you get to the airport, if you're checking anything in, getting there in plenty of time for the security check, you could drive there. You could drive yourself there and basically be the master of your destiny. Is the megabus making any mounting a serious challenge to the railways, because they do have Wi-Fi? I've got kids who've ridden it back and forth to Chicago. Is that a serious contender, or is it just kind of a side player?
No, you're absolutely right. It is a major contender. And again, kind of that same change in kind of the next generation, Generation X and Y, they really seem to be showing an affinity. And we may have spoken about this a little bit last time about, you know, for denser living patterns in the city level. Also, how they prefer to travel. Like you just mentioned, they want Wi-Fi access. They want a more affordable option, too. And Megabus and other players that certainly we have here, at least in the Northeast, I'm not sure exactly what's in the Midwest, but some run by Greyhound, others private companies, are doing incredibly well. In fact, just in your neck of the woods, DePaul University is kind of the main spot researching these inner-city bus modes, and it turns out that they are basically the single fastest-growing inner-city transportation mode in the country. Now, it helps when you start from a really low baseline, because no one was really seeming to take the bus or the Greyhound.
Right.
But the growth has been just dramatic. And as you mentioned, you know, folks, by the time you go to the airport, and then also with the airport you land in and get to the place where you're going, it takes so long. Driving's completely competitive from that kind of actual travel time standard. So if you are going to be using the roads versus the rails, at least the buses offer you that opportunity that we just talked about amenity-wise. They offer the Wi-Fi, You can even just be reading a book more casually versus being behind the wheel.
You can sleep.
And so there's certain advantages to it. And the price is competitive. As I just mentioned, gas prices are up. People are spending more and more of their household income. In the end of the day, it's going to be cheaper to actually take the megabus between the places.
So we have options. We do indeed. Well, we'll be watching as Amtrak looks ahead into 2013, and we'll certainly be checking in for further conversations with Adi Tomer, researcher with the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
From trains to automobiles, 2013 got off to a vibrant start for the U.S. carmakers. The Detroit 3 reporting January car sales marked double-digit gains over the same time a year ago. Overall car sales topped 1 million last month, and that is up 14% from January 2012. So it looks like good days ahead for the car companies as we move into 2013. And yet, Detroit News business columnist Daniel House is worried. Dan joins us now. So, Dan, are you worried looking ahead into 2013?
Well, I don't know that worried is the right word, but I'm certainly reminded of what we saw in early 2000 when you had companies making a lot of money basically on two or four products coming out of a couple of plants, pickups and SUVs, and they were losing money on everything else. And now here we are a dozen years later, and they clearly have fixed their business in the United States and are doing very well and making more money than any of us can remember. That said, in other parts of the world, they're having some serious challenges, and I think we'll continue to have serious challenges, particularly in Europe. And now here in the United States, you've got this tension between what's happening in Washington and what appears to be happening in the economy. Car sales are up, as you point out. Mm-hmm. Equity prices in the stock market are doing very well. Of course, there's nowhere else you can earn any return on your money, but that's essentially why that's happening. But you have additional headwinds that are issuing from Washington, and my contention is that at some point something's going to have to give here.
Well, let's talk about the situation here at home. Certainly, we're not back to the good old days where we had that annual average of it was like 16.8 million mm-hmm. vehicles in those 10 years leading up to 2007 before the Great Recession. But we should be seeing something in the neighborhood of 15.5 mm-hmm. million for light vehicles, which is still higher than the recent pace, so things are moving in the right direction.
And no question, and yeah. I don't misunderstand me. I think they are moving in the right direction, and I think clearly we'll probably get to 16. I mean, there's a lot of pent up demand in the marketplace, and I think you're seeing a lot of replacement out there. You're seeing much better product. You're seeing better fuel efficiency, so people are more inclined to want to make a move.
And the aging car fleet.
Aging car fleet. We're up close to 11 years, the oldest fleet in anybody's memory. Cars are easier to finance than they had been in any time in the last 5 years, so you can get financing out there. So there's a lot of reasons, I think, to be confident or mm-hmm. upbeat. I think my point is there's a lot of storm clouds out there, and we don't exactly know how this is going to play out over the longer term.
So I think what I'm hearing you say is be wary, Detroit 3, as you look on the horizon.
Well, I think we know, people that have been around this state and this industry for a long time know that there are two kinds of things that go on in traditionally the Detroit industry. One is the cyclicality of the business itself, and the other is the cycle of complacency and euphoria. Mm. And I think the managements of these companies are much better at managing that cycle of complacency and euphoria. They're much more realistic about the challenges out there. They know that the competition is very intense and will continue to be intense. And a lot of the players are playing here on the home turf, Volkswagen being the most recent coming to Tennessee and building vehicles down there, and they mm-hmm. are coming on like gangbusters. So I think going forward, these companies are likely to be more realistically managed. So I think that's less of a challenge.
And would some of that or a lot of that perhaps be, in your view, because it's unlike back in 2000, it's outsiders who have come in and have the reins of power now?
Unfortunately, I think I have to say yes. I think they bring in a different sensibility. Although I think you got to be careful with that, because if you look at Ford, for example, Al Mulally has done what he's has accomplished what he's accomplished at Ford, pretty much with Ford people.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a question of leadership and the kind of leadership that you have, and how you approach the business. General Motors, I think, is a different animal. It went through bankruptcy. Ford did not.
Mm-hmm.
Chrysler is a different animal, altogether. It is now controlled by a foreign a company. And in some
ways, keeping that company afloat, what we had.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
But for Chrysler's earnings at the end of the year, Fiat would have lost like about $1.3 billion. So it's keeping Fiat above water, barely. And but yeah, I think leadership is critical here. And also their business models are much more competitive, lower debt loads. They're generating a lot more cash. Their break-even point is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 10.5 million units a year. So anything that these companies, any time that the selling rate in the United States is above that level, and it's way above that level now, it's just a license to print money. And that's what they're doing. And we tend to focus on the glass being half empty, but there's also some evidence that the glass is half full and that there is opportunity in the economy. And I think some people increasingly are starting to look at that.
Dan Howes, as always, pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for sharing time with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure.
Daniel Howes is a business columnist for the Detroit News. Coming up next, a conversation with music teacher, composer, and performer Bill Ryan about his post-minimalist music. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to one of the leading lights on the new music scene, Bill Band, led by composer and educator Bill Ryan. It's been 9 years since the last CD release from Bill Band, although Bill Ryan's continued to make his mark on contemporary music with his teaching at Grand Valley State University and the GVSU New Music Ensemble. It's really putting Grand Valley and Michigan on the map for those who follow and love contemporary music. So now, after 9 years, comes a new release from Bill Band. It's called Towards Daybreak, with emotive post-minimalist new music. Composer, conductor, producer, and educator Bill Ryan joins us now from Grand Valley State. Bill, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. Well, you and Bill Band got so much critical praise with your 2004 album, Blurred. So why did it take nearly a decade for you to return to Bill Band?
Well, life. There's the short answer. That came out in 2004, and the very next year I moved, relocated from New York to West Michigan, and came to, I got a position at Grand Valley State University. And then why I got that position was I wanted to sort of start a new music culture, contemporary music culture, and that took a lot of work. And so I started an ensemble, and we did a couple cool projects, including three CD commercially released products. And I have found that I can only keep one of those going at once. So I did continue to write slowly, but really that was my focus, to sort of set up a nice foundation. And then that's done. And now, so the time is perfect for me to kind of refocus back to my own stuff for a bit.
And just for folks who may not be familiar with Bill Band, the musicians who work with you, tell us a little about them. Where are they from, and how long have you worked together?
Yeah, I like to produce events and create events and make connections. And so a lot of what I do, in addition to composing, is produce concert series and do kind of residency educational things at my institutions. And so when I was in New York at Suffolk Community College, I met all of these players, most of these players, by supporting them in what they do as performers and composers and presenting them. So that's how I got to meet these people. And then we became really terrific friends through that work, and since then have specifically written music for them. There are five players in the group from New York from those days, and then also two of my colleagues at Grand Valley State are in the ensemble. And then we had an eighth member who's now in Chicago, who's in the ensemble. So it's a sort of scattering of locations, but a really super core group of people. I believe a lot in team chemistry. And that is, I think, has a lot to do with the success of how well they play.
I would have to imagine that it's so important for the kind of music you play, where there really is a real core connection between everybody.
Yeah, that's right. It's it's chamber music, so in terms of how they realize things, there's no conductor, so there's a ton of communication going on, subtle communication, with glances and little physical gestures, and all of these players have worked together in various capacities and really know one another professionally and personally. And they're all great improvisers. They're comfortable playing music, classical music or pop music or jazz music, and so they exist in these different worlds, which is really critical to my music. You know, I need those kind of players that have that understanding.
But can you give us some sense of how Towards Daybreak, the new release, differs from your 2004 release, Blurred?
Yeah, I mentioned before life sort of happened in this distance between 9 years ago. And this music is all coming more from, as I get older, as we all do, we accumulate experiences, good and bad. And that has for sure happened to me, and I've noticed more of those, that experience coming out in my music, and so a lot of these tracks on the CD are reflecting a particular experience or an event or a more general thing. There's a track that I wrote for my father who passed away right when I moved out here. There's another for my mother who passed away earlier, but then there's also positive. There's a track on there that kind of reminds me of my two girls.
Which track is that?
Around. And that's called Sparkle. That was originally commissioned by a dance company, Karen Stokes Dance, down in Houston a couple years ago. But as I wrote, even when I was writing it, I don't know, for some reason, my girls, who are Sophia and Annalie, 9 and 12, just sort of jumped into my head as I was writing. And so it's kind of this like sparkly, girly, positive little piece.
It's a wonderful track.
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask in a moment if you'll tell us which tracks came from losing your parents. But before you tell us, I'd like, if I might, to hazard a guess. And I'll say that because a loved one who's very, very dear to me has just been moved into hospice. Mm-hmm. So I'm beginning the process of saying goodbye to her. And I'm going to tell you, without knowing what tracks were related to your parents, I found that track 8, which is Blurred, really captures what I'm feeling inside. Was that one of the ones for your parents?
Track 8 was, sort of that started all of this. My mother was killed in an automobile accident in 2000. Mm-hmm. Obviously very tragic and sort of knocked me off my feet artistically for several years, and I wasn't able to get anything together to write. And when I was sort of finally able to, 2003-ish, that's the piece that came out. I wasn't sort of consciously trying to do that. It just, that was just, I was consumed with that. And track 8 was the result of that. And then track 1, what opens the CD is Simple Lines, and that's a sort of a lush cello piece that's concerned with my father's passing. He passed away from cancer, and was again, I didn't set out to write a piece about him.
Yes.
It was more like I was in this certain frame of mind and reflecting a lot on his life. And that piece came out.
And you've had to really cope with the two extremes, the sudden loss and then the protracted dying, that you had to live through that. And you really do hear it in the tracks.
Oh, yeah. I just find it very interesting. When I was a young composer, I approached my music based on that sort of absolute things like, oh, that's an interesting rhythm, let me explore that, or that's an interesting melody, with no thoughts of kind of extra musical events. And as these experiences have happened, both good and bad, I just find my frame of mind changing when I write.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and speaking with Bill Ryan, composer, teacher, and his new CD with his band, Bill Band, is out now. It's called Toward Daybreak, and certainly making his mark on contemporary music as a teacher at Grand Valley State University, and also leading the GVSU New Music Ensemble, which has done very, very well. And it's just amazing to think that these young musicians can come to you and wind up kind of fast-tracking themselves into a process of recording CDs and making music that's acclaimed from coast to coast. And I wonder, as you look at those youngsters, do you see yourself, well, your early years when you first became drawn to music?
That's a good question. I suppose in a way. I mean, when I was very young, I was just very curious, and many of our students come here and they're not exposed to contemporary music because
right.
the literature they tend to play is hundreds of years old by people that aren't on the planet anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so just seeing my students, sort of their eyes light up when they are exposed to someone, when they get to meet a composer in the flesh, that reminds me. I mean, because for sure, I went to school to be a band teacher and a trumpet player. And then later in my training, as a junior maybe, I became real interested and exposed, thanks to my teacher, to contemporary music. So that does remind me a little bit of my path.
You compose, you produce, you teach. Are there other career goals that you're aiming for?
Other career goals? You know, I have to say I am super content. I love what I do. I love the fact that I do have these different, you know, I'm just not a composer, which is mm-hmm. possibly why maybe I'm not prolific as those that are, but I do like to produce events. I love to teach. And I think of it, if I didn't love to teach and I was just pursuing writing, my teaching would suffer and my students would as well. So, I very content. I would love it if I could continue to work with this ensemble, the Bill Band Group, maybe write another CD or two. So who knows?
Bill Ryan, his all-star septet is Bill Band, and their new release is Towards Daybreak. And, of course, he'll be continuing teaching at Grand Valley State, GVSU, New Music Ensemble. Much happening in new music in West Michigan, all thanks to Bill Ryan. Thanks for talking with us today, Bill.
Thanks so much for having me.
From Grand Rapids to Ann Arbor. When it comes to data and knowing just what to do with it, it seems there are two camps in this world. There's Group A, we'll call them, those who can plunge in there, mining, parsing, analyzing, and figuring out how to really use data. And then there's Group B, those who are fairly clueless when it comes to crunching data, and who, by the way, are in relative awe of Group A. Luckily for some nonprofit groups in the Ann Arbor, Detroit area, those Group A types aren't just smart, they're nice, and they're willing to help the Group Bs. It's the A2 Data Dive, and it's happening this weekend on the central campus of the University of Michigan, thanks to some hardworking grad students at the U of M School of Information. Here to tell us more about the A2 Data Dive are the co-founders, both of them grad students at the School of Information, Claire Barco and Nikki Rota. I want to start with you, Claire, for those of us who are Group Bs, just what is a data dive?
Okay, so a data dive is kind of like a hackathon. It's a weekend-long service event. It's about 30 hours where we get nonprofits and the Group A's and the Group B's all together in one room, and they just kind of skill share. The Group A's are able to analyze and crunch data for the nonprofits mm-hmm. that they've been collecting. The Group B's get to see how it's all done. So it's a lot of learning, it's a lot of sharing, it's a lot of helping people out, and there's a lot of coffee involved.
A lot of coffee. A lot of coffee and sandwiches and keeping people fueled up, I guess. Nikki, what do the data divers get out of this? It's clear that the nonprofits have to be thrilled having help with crunching this data and knowing what to do with it. But what do the data divers get out
of it? That's an absolutely wonderful question. And I think last year, Claire and I definitely saw what they got out of it was the opportunity to volunteer in a way that got to tease their brain a bit. So the number of people that came up to us, and this wasn't just students, right? So we were inviting the entire Ann Arbor community. So we have students, we have faculty, we have local practitioners, you know, statisticians and the like, would come up to us and say thank you. And a lot of them ended up establishing relationships with the nonprofits they were working with to maybe continue that volunteer relationship.
So in general, then, they come in, the nonprofits, with what? What is it that you are diving into? Have they collected stuff? What are they coming in with?
Yeah. So nonprofits are aware, like all Group A's, mm-hmm. that data is important. It's becoming more important as we go along. Making database decisions is really necessary at this point to show to your donors that you are effective. So nonprofits are collecting data about their participants, about the numbers of people they're serving, about the areas that they're reaching out to, but they don't necessarily have the skills to turn that data mm-hmm. into real solid facts that they can show their donor.
So each nonprofit is paired with a team of graduate students. So obviously Claire and I are involved on kind of like the higher organizational level, but each nonprofit has a set of what we're calling data ambassadors who help usher the volunteers through the process all day of Saturday of working on the data. So having an intimate knowledge of the data that is being provided, having a knowledge about the organization, being able there to answer questions and refocus work that's being done. Yeah. And more importantly, connect people to each other. Oh, I see that you're working on maps over here. Did you know this other team is also thinking about doing that? Maybe you guys can collaborate. And last but not least, the most important part of the day for both the volunteers and the nonprofits is actually writing up documentation of everything that they're doing. So ultimately, we want the nonprofits to be able to walk away with this amazing visualization or this really fun tool. But most importantly, we'd like them to walk away also with a long list of detailed instructions as to how the volunteers got to that point. Mm. So that at any point, these nonprofits, if they want to tweak it, if they want to recreate it, if they want to show their donors, you name it, that they have some documentation as a way to explain what's going on over the course of Saturday.
Claire, this is exciting you. What do you want to say?
Yes. In fact, we were able to see from last year's mm-hmm. data dive that is possible. That does happen. Mm-hmm. Last year, we worked with a nonprofit called the African Health Open Educational Resources Network, or AHON for short. And as we documented everything along the way, the leadership of AHON was able to hold their own data dive with their own volunteers at a workshop they held in Ghana last summer. So in fact, it's kind of like a drop in the bucket. Not only do data divers get to learn and share skills and meet new people, but the nonprofits themselves get to learn new skills and learn how to do it themselves.
Best of luck, both
Thank
of you,
you.
Claire
you so
Barco
much.
And Nikki Rota, the co-founders of the A2 Data Dive. And it'll be a busy weekend. Get the coffee brewing.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Most definitely.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
The A2 Data Dive happens this weekend on the University of Michigan main campus in Ann Arbor. There are free workshops you can attend. And if you're listening in West Michigan or another part of the state and want to learn more about how your nonprofit could participate in next year's dive, or you have skills in data analysis and want to volunteer, you can go to a2datadive.org. Now, we want to invite you to tune into Michigan Radio tomorrow afternoon at 3 for a special State of Opportunity call-in show. Michigan Radio's Jen White will examine the importance of pre-K education. Along with panelists and your calls, they'll explore why early education matters so much for Michigan's most vulnerable kids and for our state's future. Again, tomorrow at 3, right here on Michigan Radio. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. The program was engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Maya Friedman, and Austin Davis. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3.